information available at thealex.com/shows and kpfk.org.
This is Quetzal Flores from the band Quetzal, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 Los Angeles.
The Expansion Zone with Sonia Barrett.
Everybody's talking about consciousness. Everybody wants that eternal kiss. Yeah, everyone's saying there's more than this. Everyone wants to follow their own bliss. Talking about one love, one blood, we sing.
On The Expansion Zone, we examine life and our quest to understand who and what we are and of the vastness of human potentials. We explore the making of our world from quantum physics to parapsychology, health, sociology, and philosophy, along with practical living. You are reminded of the possibilities in creating personal change. So for an hour, we'll stimulate and expand the mind. Well, welcome once again to another edition of The Expansion Zone with Sonia Barrett. I am Sonia Barrett, your host. And as always, thank you so much for tuning in on this Monday on KPFK 90.7 FM here in Southern California. And the show, of course, airs on Mondays at 1 p.m. Pacific time. So, yeah, I'm sounding maybe a tad bit nasal. Ate a couple things yesterday that was not the thing to do. And so I'm having a little bit of a food allergy response, but it's all good. You know, the body does what it does. It says we need to get rid of it. So that's kind of what's happening, but otherwise everything's good. So based on today's show, here's my quote, a quote that I found. In the middle of winter, I at last discovered that there was in me an invisible summer. By Albert Camus. And I thought it was a really great quote, that whole idea. In the middle of winter, I at last discovered that there was in me an invisible summer. And of course, that's, you know, what we go through. We go through our winters in our mind, very dark moments sometimes. And, you know, that light suddenly sparks up and reminds you. So we're going to get into that topic today. And I've had psychologists on, I've had many kinds of discussions about depression and just, you know, maybe mental illness to some degree. And we've talked about it mainly professionally, but to also speak to somebody that knows what that feels like, I think is something that I wanted to explore at this time. Somebody who knows what it feels like, but not only know what it feels like, but also know what it is to keep rising every day and in every moment, and tools and tips, particularly now in the age that we are in, the time that we're in, where more people are experiencing these kinds of feelings and emotions, and perhaps not expressing it to others because it's not they don't want to not feel normal, or for whatever the reason, embarrassment. There's so many different reasons. But what I can tell you is that we all experience these various emotions at different times. It's, you know, some people become more caught in those experiences a lot longer. So we'll talk about that a bit more. So anyway, today's topic is you aren't depression's victim. And it's this is going to be discussed by my guest, Deborah Atlas, who is actually the author of the book, You Aren't Depression's Victim. And just a short, read a little bit of her bio here. Deborah Atlas has been a professional writer, blogger, and journalist since 2008, a member of the Society of Environmental Journalists. Her articles have covered topics as wide ranging as climate change, green innovation, and agricultural themes. Her work has been published in newspapers, in regional and national magazines, and on numerous web and blog sites. This is her first published book, the first of what she hopes will be many, and is a departure from all that comes before. An outside-the-box thinker with a wide range of interests, Ms. Atlas believes finding daily inspiration is crucial to living a balanced, happy life. And so she continually strives to find inspiration and shares what she discovers with others. And of course, her website, we'll talk about or how to get a hold of her, DeborahAtlas@gmail.com. So without further ado, Deborah Atlas, welcome to the Expansion Zone.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, before we dive in, I'm going to read a couple of lines from the back of your book, because when I read the bio, of course, it doesn't give that this part of it. And of course, you will share with us more details. But on the back of her book, it says, although she lived with depression since the age of two, Atlas's illness wasn't diagnosed until her late 40s. Yeah. Growing up, life looked normal on the outside, but felt devastatingly painful inside. Living an odd man out roller coaster like life. Atlas kept her depression hidden from family and friends until she attempted suicide at age 14. So, Deborah, This is no small stuff right here, what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And the idea that one could be depressed at two is not something that we entertain or understand or maybe even consider. So where do you want to begin with filling us in on maybe your early beginnings with these kinds of feelings, or when you recognize that there's something a little bit off about how I feel?
I always felt that I was different from the rest of my family, and my parents kind of felt that too. They really didn't know what to do with me. I thought differently. I looked at things differently. I responded differently than everyone else. And it was, you know, I eventually learned how to kind of keep a somewhat low profile in the family so that I wasn't constantly getting into trouble for everything. But, you know, and then there were other moments. But, you know, when I say I was depressed since age two, it was that there's something different and I don't understand why, and why do I feel this way? But you know, when you're that young, you don't know how to articulate it, and nobody's around to say, honey, it's okay. It's okay to be different. In my family, it wasn't okay to be different. Our family was a family of high achievers. You know, I have to say we were a family of type A's, and I wasn't that, but I strove to get to that, you know, and never quite met the mark on it, until, you know, when I was in late junior high, and then I found something that I excelled at for the first time. And that was a lifeline for me, an absolute lifeline for me. You know, I have a brother, my older brother, who is just this shy of genius. At least that's what I say. He would never say that, but I say that. And then I came next. And everybody expected I'd be like him, but I wasn't. And so, you know, I had that going on as well.
That's not unusual for people to, and I didn't mean to cut you there, but I think for people to sort of come into that space of feeling inadequate, which of course sort of shapes into a sense of depression because they're trying to live up to these models and ideals and ideas socially and particularly family.
Yes. Yes. And that's, you know, one thing that I learned, and it's something that most people don't know about people who have depression. We are masters of disguise. We have to be. We have learned how to blend in. We have learned, for the most part, many people, how not to have your depression show. I mean, unless it's incredibly severe or you're deep in the midst of serious depression, obviously. But people walk around being depressed and you'd never know. You know, I read a statistic that just knocked my socks off that 2/3 of people suffering from depression are undiagnosed.
I believe
so they
that.
Don't even know. They don't even know.
Yeah, I completely believe that. And, you know, I look back, and it wasn't until many years later that I look back at a moment in my life and going through, you know, having gone through a divorce, those crazy things. And I went through a phase where I believe I was depressed, but I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And it wasn't, we weren't really talking about it maybe in the 90s. It just wasn't. So, but then I look back and I realize, wow, I think you were. I think you may have even had a nervous breakdown. I mean, so there are things that go on with us, is the whole point.
Yeah.
And you don't know. You just right. don't know. But I tell you, what I did was walk. I did a lot of walking, and I think that was like, you know, it was like a drug for me.
Well, and you're not alone in that. You know, I have strategies to help me stave off depression. One of them is to get moving. And another of them is to be out in nature. Those two things are lifesavers for me and for many
people
with depression.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're exactly right. You're absolutely right. I cannot emphasize going out in nature enough to people. People who are dealing with heavy duty anxiety and so on. And people, you know, you'll ask, do you go out in nature? And somebody will say, well, you know, every now and then. And I'm like, you have no idea how healing it is to get out there chemically.
Right.
It, you know, is a process, not just you're looking at, you know, the trees are beautiful, but there's a chemical response that is happening in your body and in your brain at that moment. So, all right. So let's, you know, keep going here in the sense of what other aspects you would like to share in coming to whatever conclusions that sort of started bringing you into maybe some more awareness or balance or.
Well, I'll tell you what happened when I was not in balance. And I'm not alone again in this. You know, my book, You Aren't Depression's Victim, I wrote it because there's so much that so many of us go through and it's not written or talked about. You know, we grew up in a time where depression wasn't talked about. In my family, certainly, we never talked about it. And, you know, one of the things that I did when I was deep into depression is I would do what I call hibernate. I would go in my house or my apartment. I would lock the door. I, you know, pull the shades. I would turn the answering machine on. I would not call people. I would not return calls, not take calls. I would not, and just didn't see anybody. And it could be days and sometimes weeks. Now, that
you want to zone out.
Yeah. And it was a very dark and gray environment I was living in personally, deeply within. And, you know, those times I didn't know when they were going to happen. I didn't know when they were going to end. And, you know, I talk in the book about a friend of mine who basically did an intervention when I was deep in the midst, and I resisted every second of it. You know, I did my usual hibernating, and this was a guy I was dating. And one day he came over and he called and I didn't answer. Then he rang the doorbell and I didn't answer. Then he started banging on the door and I didn't answer. Then he started yelling through the door and he said, I'm not going away until you open this door. And I said, leave me alone. He said, I will not. And eventually I'm spitting nails and eventually I opened the door and spitting nails at him. And he said, listen, you are coming with me and we are going out. And I said, no. And eventually, you know, he's persuasive. So I went out with him and I was very shut down, but eventually, slowly, I began to open up just a little bit, enough to start being a little more present. See, that's the thing. When you're deep in depression, you're not present. There are wonderful things can be happening. It can be the most gorgeous day. And for you, it is dark and gloomy and awful.
And yeah, that's you're lost in it. Yeah, you're caught in it like a web.
That's right. And he helped pull me back into life, for which I will be incredibly grateful forever. And, you know, and I tell people, you know, when people ask me, what can I do if I have someone who's like that? I said, have courage, you know, have courage, go and be with them. They're going to try and have you not be with them. Persist gently, you know, and then listen, ask questions. You know, as a journalist, we ask, you know, open-ended questions, who, what, where, when. Ask those kinds of questions and then shut up and listen. It's very hard for people who have depression to talk about it. Incredibly hard. But if you get them to begin and ask those kinds of questions and listen, you will make a huge difference in someone's life.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, what happens is this pattern is forming. It's like anything else that's a habit, you know, that becomes a habit. When you sink into a depression, you're sinking. Now your brain starts to recognize this as normal. And then, you know, you're basically addicted to the depression and you're just in it. And I think that's something that people really need to understand, just like everything else. And then it becomes harder. It's no different than when you have an addiction to something, you have a hard time letting it go, whether it be smoking or I'm not saying that that's the emotional experience. I'm just talking about chemically how we, you know, we form these patterns. And when this boyfriend pulled you out, he started pulling apart the pattern that was setting in place.
You know, at one point while I was writing the book, I went back to a therapist that I had worked with, the one who diagnosed me with depression, to ask him not only about my time with him, because there was so much going on, I didn't remember a lot, just highly emotional. So it's hard to remember those things during those times. But he also gave me some very good information that I didn't know, like, as you just pointed to, there's a direct correlation between addiction and depression. People who are deep into addictions are incredibly depressed. And it's like, not sure the chicken and the egg, but they're very much intertwined.
Absolutely.
And I hadn't thought about that before.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Because I've been saying that for a long time, because I recognized, you know, obviously the part of the brain that tends to regulate habit forming and, you know, pattern forming. And like anything else, eventually it becomes your normal. Whatever that is, it becomes your normal. And you're so invested, which is what you're saying with what you can remember and all of that, because you're invested and consumed by what that moment represents.
Very well put. That's exactly right. You can't see anything else. You can't grasp anything else that's going on around you. I remember times I would come out of my depression and I'd look around and I'd see these opportunities that I'd missed that would have been so wonderful to tap into, but I couldn't see them. And they were in front of me, but I couldn't see them to take advantage of them because everything was like this. It was tunnel vision. And anything over here? No. Anything over here? No, didn't exist.
Like running a program that, you know, it's like that's the program that was being run and it was a featured program. And so you're running that and don't anybody interrupt me. You know, so when anybody tries to come, don't even try. It's like, I'm running this program and I don't want it interrupted. So I get it. And I think that there are times in, I think in a large portion of the population where even if it's for a day that you experience this, or 2 days, or if you have a breakup, right, from a relationship. Right. I remember.
I want to make a distinction, however. Mm-hmm. There's a big distinction between being depressed and having depression.
Right. Right.
Many people go through times when they feel depressed.
Right.
But as my therapist told me, he said, there's a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Mm-hmm.
But someone who lives with depression, there is no beginning, middle, and an end. You are there, you're in it, or you're not. And there's no precursor you can point to most of the time to say, boom. No, it's just A plus B equals C. However,
that's your world.
Having said that, what I talk about in the book, You Aren't Depression's Victim, is there are ways that you can help yourself recognize that you are about to go down that path. And it starts with becoming aware of what you're doing and what's happening. Now, one of the things I talk about a lot in the book is, and we all know, we have perceptions about things, all of us, about everything. You know, something happens and we have a perception about what that means or what that's going to mean. Or somebody says something and our perception is it means X. Does it? Maybe, maybe not. But our perception says it means this. And people who have depression latch onto that and go, poof, over.
Yeah.
But what if, and I talk about this in the book, what if you didn't have to go poof down into that deep hole of depression, into the rabbit hole? What if you didn't have to? What if there were ways you could help yourself to recognize that it was, you were on that path and go, wait, no, I'm not going there today. And there were things by working in therapy and on my own that I began to see things that I did that I wasn't aware of that would lead me down that path. For example, I began to recognize that I have a dog. I've had dogs for years. And I, about the time that I was, just after I was diagnosed with depression, which was a shocking, wonderful revelation, I began to notice that when I would start going down into depression, I would go down on the floor with my dog, not necessarily fetal position, but I'd go down on the floor with him and just, you know, just stay down there a while. And I can tell you that would lead me instantly to fall into the pit. So now, on those rare occasions that I go down, and it's very rare, but it has happened in the last few years, I let myself go down for a minute. And then I go, okay, that's enough. Get up, get moving. Another thing I do, when I start to feel like, you know, I'm right up against it, I turn to my dog and I say, okay, let's go dance. And I go put on some very upbeat, fun music, and he grabs a toy and we dance around the living room, because I have noticed that there is physically no way that you can be sad and depressed when you're dancing full out. You can't, not when you're dancing full out to upbeat music. And that, again, is another lifesaver, another strategy that I've discovered that helps me step away from depression and the depression pit. And it's easy to do.
Yeah, absolutely. It's easy to do. Yeah. And it's a matter of just making that choice. And yes, I'm glad you made the distinction between being depressed or living in depression, or is, I think that's, is that how you phrased it?
Being depressed or having depression.
Having depression, right. And I think what I wanted to do is just to give people who have just had those moments of it an idea of what that would be like if you lived like that every day.
Yeah.
So, but to recognize those moments when you've had that, maybe it's for a couple of days, I mean, and you manage to pull yourself out. If you can't pull yourself out, which is, I think, what you're also talking about, it can continue this journey down this rabbit hole where you are stuck. You're stuck in that state. And also what I was going to say is when you were saying that, I remember when I mentioned relationships, I remember going through a breakup many years ago. It was just so devastating. Yeah. And you want to cocoon yourself,
yeah,
and you just want to stay there. You know, I used
comfortable.
Yeah, it's comfortable. Let the cobwebs grow on me. It's fine. I don't care. And you just want to stay, and you feel like you could stay there forever. Now, I remember making a conscious decision to go, okay, all right, stop. Today, you're going to, for 5 minutes, you're not going to think about it. I have to negotiate with myself for an hour, for two hours, until eventually, till eventually I stopped. But it's those kinds of tips which you're talking about, that's simple, but you're making conscious, present choices.
That's right. And, you know, a lot of people who suffer from depression don't understand or don't know that they can choose, that they can have those moments of choice. It's, you know, I walk them through in the book, the strategies, the steps to help you become aware. And then what do you do? You know, how can you help yourself? There's no one thing that works for everybody. You know, I talk about a lot of different strategies and a lot of different things that can help people, because one person might say, oh, this is great, it's perfect for me. And somebody else goes, nothing work at all. But then there's this. So, you know, I know that there are different kinds of depression. I know that there are different points of view and perspectives that we all have about it and how we live with it. And I talk about all those different viewpoints and strategies and ways of looking at things. You know, I've been accused years ago of being an outside the box kind of gal. You know, I've never looked at, I can't, it's like cooking. I can't cook a recipe straight to save my life. Can't do it, because I'm always going, oh, but it'll be better this way. And that's what I do in business and in relationships and everything. It's, I look at things differently. And that is, as an adult anyway, it's a great advantage. Not necessarily as a kid, it wasn't, but as an adult, it's a good advantage.
Well, it gives you variety. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. It's your variety, you know, and there's a brain impact, and you're creating new neural pathways, you're trying new things. And that really does help serve to keep you more excited, you know, with life, because you're not having to stick to just a ritual,
right,
and, you know, of behavior. You're not being confined.
It keeps you engaged.
It keeps you engaged.
Anything that keeps you engaged in life and present is a wonderful thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I think that let's take our station break. We want to take our station break. And when we come back, we will continue this very necessary and very uplifting conversation with my guest, Deborah Atlas. So please stay tuned, and we will be right back after this brief break.
The Bradcast.
Experts have said that the case has little chance of success at the Supreme Court, much like the numerous other GOP election lawsuits that are pending in battleground states. But then again, those experts, they are just guessing. They are hoping.
With your host, Brad Friedman, and producer, Desi Doyen.
There's enough going on right now. There are enough X factors still remaining that that's one I'd rather not contemplate.
Correct. You are, as usual, correct, Desi Doyen.
Tune in to The Bradcast every Monday at 3 p.m. right here on KPFK.
And we are back. Welcome back. Of course, we're coming to you from KPFK 90.7 FM in Southern California, and we are streaming live at kpfk.org. You are listening to The Expansion Zone with Sonia Barrett. That's me. And speaking with my guest today, Deborah Atlas, who is the author of you aren't depression's victim. And it is such a wonderful and necessary conversation at this time. And I love the direction that she's coming from with this, because there's so many tools and tips. And I think anybody really can benefit from reading this book. So I commend her on having such a great first publication. So anyway, let's explore some other areas of this. Now, do you work with people as well?
As in
any kind of, I don't know if you do coaching or consultation or any of that. Do you work with others? Because somebody might be thinking, you know, does she work with other people?
I'm not a therapist. Let me say that. Right. I'm not a therapist. I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a psychiatrist. And I would never, ever presume to market myself as that. In business, I have been a coach before. I have been a consultant. But that's not what I do anymore. I'm strictly a journalist at this point. I am, however, beginning to work on the materials that will lead to my leading a workshop based on this book. I'm in discussions right now with a company about doing that for their facility.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, because right, it is exciting. And workshops can be so incredibly beneficial based on your book, because here it is, somebody has the book, the book is part of the workshop, and people get to have these one-on-one, questions. It's a group, but they're asking questions about some of the tips and tools that you're sharing, and questions and, you know, additional insights. So I think that's very exciting.
And the thing that excites me is not only that I'll be reaching people in a very intimate format, but that their questions can lead to other strategies that I had never thought about. And that's exciting.
That is very exciting. Because, you know, I do a lot of workshops. So yeah, it's interesting because people get to share some of the things that, you know, they've been doing as well. And maybe somebody else says something, and then it's an added piece for someone else to go, oh, wow, you know, I hadn't thought of that. But so I wanted to see here, you've got, I wanted to check out some of the chapters here. What are some of the other things that you think that would be beneficial to people based on all that you've written here? Miracles, challenges, and loss equals
that's a very
more
good,
choice.
Thank you for bringing that up. I am a firm believer in miracles in life. Now, let me immediately define what I mean by that. I've had several serious health issues over the years as an adult. I had chronic fatigue, and it was really bad. And I lived by myself, so it was very interesting getting through it. And during that time, because it was so severe and I could really do nothing, really nothing. And I decided that, you know, I'd gone down as far as I could go, please God, and that I needed to start looking for the miracles in my life. And the miracles I defined them as something simple, like the sun was shining that day. Or I was out in the country and I could hear the brook that was on our property. You know, I could hear it from the house, or there was some deer in the front yard, you know? And so for me, I began this practice of being committed to finding three miracles every day and naming them, because the spoken word is very powerful, very powerful. If I say something's a miracle, it is, and it uplifts me. And I desperately needed something to uplift me during that very dark time. And so during those months of getting through the worst of chronic fatigue, that's what my mantra became. Every day, my practice was, okay, what are the three miracles today? And when I get into situations since then, where it can be a crisis or it can be something devastating happens and it seems to be prolonged, I go back to, okay, it's time to start looking for miracles. Because the miracles get me for a moment to step outside of how I feel, how I think, the situation and circumstances and everything related to it, and just focus on something amazing. And it works. You know, I tell people all the time, you know, people that ask me, what can I do? Practice looking for three miracles every day. You'll be amazed at how it shifts your perspective, even if just for a moment. And if you can shift your perspective for a moment every day, imagine that over time.
So absolutely. It's like the idea of pain, of being in pain. And if they say, if you can, you know, shift out of pain for a moment, then gradually over time, you can shift out of pain yes. completely.
That's right.
And, it's the same premise. But the idea of really finding something that you are grateful for. And yeah, we talk about gratitude all the time. And I'm glad you sort of explained it in a way that people don't think, oh, here we go again with the
right.
gratitude,
right.
you know, thing. But it's, you know, there's a science behind everything.
Yes.
And that idea of truly going, wow, you know what? I'm really grateful for this, whatever that is right now, and
yeah.
really feeling that in a personal way can really
yeah.
remind you that there is hope, that
yeah.
there is more,
yes.
and that you are more. And I also want to ask you, okay, so as far as self-esteem, as far as comparisons, to maybe people in your family, did that really ultimately change for you, or was that something that you quietly still sort of struggled with? And you know, where do you how do you feel about yourself right now and your accomplishments and the freedom to just be whoever it is you are and are being?
I got to a place, I don't know how many years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 20 something. And I was at an event where someone in my family was being honored. And, you know, I had lived in New York a very long time, and there was a lot of freedom for me out of living in New York. It was great just to be myself. In a way, for the first time, I hadn't for, you know, ever perhaps. And so I came to this event and I did or said something, and my mother looked at me and she said, "Don't you care?" And she stopped and she said, "You really don't care what people think anymore, do you?" I said, "No, I really don't. I really don't." And it's very freeing.
Oh yeah.
The public opinion, there are some people I care deeply about what they think about me, but overall, you know, it's not going to change my life that much. I mean, yeah, if a mass of humanity thinks I'm terrible, that's a whole other thing. But, you know, in general, you know, I tend to wear the things I like because I'm comfortable. I tend to do things that I love to do because they make me feel good and they make a difference. And again, it's being an outside the box kind of thinker perspective kind of person. But it took a long time to get to that place, a very long time. You know, self-esteem was a huge issue growing up. And even as an adult, there was I had been pursuing a career as a performer and an entertainer. And I got to a certain point and I was thrilled with it. And I realized I was at a crossroads. I was at a crossroads. I could either go way forward towards Broadway, do all of that, and my heart would be thrilled, or step away. And I chose to step away because I didn't feel I had the self-esteem to get through the huge amount of rejections that I would have to face. I'd already faced a lot, But when you're going that route, you better get some thick skin. And I stepped away from it and went a different path because I knew that I wouldn't make it. And I hadn't been diagnosed with depression yet. So it was a very smart move on my part, because who knows what might have occurred with my depression facing that kind of rejection. So I made the proper call at that point. Is it a regret? No. I've done things I love to do that I wouldn't have done. The book wouldn't have happened if I hadn't, you know, everything feeds into everything else in your life. And so, but that was a choice that I made.
I think that was a great choice because, you know, having gone in a similar direction, as we talked about before the show, that theater was definitely my love. Now, that the industry can be a very cruel.
It can eat very, you up.
Oh my gosh.
That's right.
Yeah. It can just destroy. And then that's why we see some people that just jump off the ride. Yeah. But it's a lot of what people think about you. And we live in a society where there is weight on most people of what others think.
Yes.
Of them, or how others perceive them. And that's a great weight, especially yes. when you are already battling with self-esteem issues.
Yes. Right. That's it right.
Is, yeah. It's very extreme. And you're doing your best to formulate, like you said, you're in a way a good performer because you managed to put on a face or a behavior that appears as if everything is okay. While on
I was a very good performer. I, you know, the last thing that I did professionally is I rented a cabaret theater and filled it and did everything I wanted to do. And it was a knockout.
Incredible.
Fabulous evening. And this was in New York. And, you know, walking home is when I had that moment of, okay, now where are you going to go? What are you going to do now?
Yeah, how do you top that now? it's the harassment, I like to call it, of the mind.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it just harasses.
I'm better at it than anybody could ever.
Yeah, it's amazing. The mind space is just something else. And, you know, the other thing to realize is, you know, we live most of life in our heads. Most there's less going on outside.
Not necessarily a pretty fun thing either.
No, it's a lot of it is in our heads and all the speculations and assessments that we make based on living in our heads and coming up with these perceptions about ourselves. Yeah. An incredible amount of weight. Now, what would you say to particularly right now in the time we're in, there's more people experiencing the states of depression or really getting consumed
yes.
and living with depression on a regular basis. I mean, what can you add based on the current times? There's all the tips you've given, but anything that you want to.
Well, first of all, and the premise behind the book is there is hope. It is not hopeless. It is not hopeless. And there is hope. You know, when COVID first hit, I almost went down the tubes like everybody else. And, you know, for the first few months, I didn't write. Everybody was glued to the news, and like I was too. And after about 3 months of this, and that's a long time, I said, this is enough. And now I am a home organic gardener, have been for decades. And I have a large garden, but I enlisted the help of a friend of mine and we almost doubled the garden size.
Wow.
And it gave me much more to do. A lot of work. Of course, the next planting season, I went, oh my God, what have I done? But that going out to my garden, I go out 4, 5, 6 times a day, sometimes just to stand there because it gives me peace. It gives me joy. I have a vegetable gardens and I have a very long flower garden. And so I added to the flower garden big time. And now it's gorgeous. And so, you know, I say to people, listen, what can you, it's again, it's about finding something that inspires you, finding something that fills your heart with joy, that nurtures you. Find something, and it's different for everyone. For me, it's gardening. For me, it's being with my dog. I started training my dog with all kinds of tricks, which he adores. I tell him, do you want to do tricks? And he lights up and smiles. You know, he knows more tricks than, it's amazing. It's amazing. You know, if I can figure out how to teach him something, he can learn anything. I've decided if I could teach him how to drive, he'd do that too.
So, that is funny.
But, you know, I tell people, find something that will, and it doesn't have to be something big, something small that will make you smile. My dog is what I call my class clown. He will do anything to make me laugh, especially when I don't want to. A lot of people after COVID hit and they were forced to stay home, got companion animals. It was a huge thing for shelters. You know, so many animals were saved. And it became a problem when people now were told they had to go back to work. But wait, I don't want to. I want to stay home with my dog.
And yes, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, it makes sense to me. I've been working from home for decades and I just, you know, can't imagine being gone anymore. I used to, but I, you know.
Right, yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, for some people, it's going out and doing something good for a neighbor. Do one thing. Do a random act of kindness. Do a something that gets you out of your head and focused on somebody else. Because that will get you out of how you feel. And that's the point. Get you out of this narrow tunnel vision thing that's going on and put your focus on something else, even if it's just for 10 minutes.
Yeah. And so it's not a rewind.
Then do it again the next day or a day or two after that. It's not hopeless.
Wow. And, you know, I found when you were talking about gardening, because I wanted to really look, I just couldn't remember clearly, but I'm just going to read this very quickly. Of course, yes, plants can reduce feelings of anxiety and depression. A 2007 study found a bacterium in plant soil called Mycobacterium vaccae, I think, that triggers the release of serotonin, which lifts mood and reduces anxiety. Therefore, interaction with indoor or outdoor plants can alleviate symptoms of depression. So I said
for years, Sonia, that one of the things I love the most is going out and getting my hands in dirt.
Yes.
Because if I can do that, the great thing about gardening, whether it's container gardening, pots indoors, doesn't make any difference. I do it all. Is that you do something and then you see the results. It's unlike anything else in my life. That's one reason I expanded the gardens big time after COVID hit, because I can go out and plant seeds. And in a week to 10 days, I see something start to come up and go, look at that. Look at that.
Something to look forward to as well. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But to give people that the information to recognize that there is more than what meets the eye actually working here, because, you know, we're part of this great network of nature, and it makes perfect sense why such healing can happen. And in my house, I have a lot of plants, and everybody comes by and they go, oh my God, how are your plants so lush and green? And, you know, they're so big. And I talk to them. So that's the other thing,
you know.
Yeah, you talk to them, and if you really, really just allow yourself, they might not speak to you verbally, but there is something that you feel. There's an engagement. I apologize when I didn't water them, you know.
I understand. And some, I tell you, when they're not doing well, I threaten them. And I say, you've got X period of time
to get it together.
Start producing. I'm getting you out of the garden. Nine times out of 10, they go, oops, okay, fine, we'll start producing that.
We'll get it together. We'll get it together.
That's right.
Yeah, it's really funny, but I do. I'm running out the door and I realize, oh my gosh, I didn't give, you know, that particular one. Because, you know, I have different plants that dry out faster.
Yeah.
And so I go, oh, I'm so sorry, but I promise as soon as I get back,
yes,
I'm going to give you water. You'll be okay till I get back.
Oh, I'm so glad I'm not the only one that does that.
I do that. And they feel good. Now, I went to the store, and you'll get a kick out of this. I was in Sprouts, and there was this rubber tree plant. It's, you know, not massive. It was small. Yeah. And it looked like it wasn't getting very much attention. And I could just feel it just being just there. It was the only yes. rubber tree plant.
Yes.
And I looked at the pot and it looked kind of dry. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to take you home with me because I have a feeling that you're not going to get the care. You're not going to get what you need, you know, here or if somebody else takes you. And so that's what happened. So I end up taking the plant home and now she's just, you know, just thriving. And you can see, I say, well, here you are with all the other plants.
Right.
Here's and your introduce cousin. The plant.
Yeah, exactly. Here's your cousins.
But all of these things that we're talking about and, you know, everything can sound so silly, but it's just all part of it. And silliness is great too.
It is, you know, we don't spend enough time with that, you know, or enough time dreaming, you know, about possibilities. You know, my book is about presenting possibilities that people don't think about or have never, it's never occurred to them. You know, again, what if it poses the question, what if you didn't have to go down that path that leads into the dark rabbit hole? What if? And then here's step this and that and that and that and think about this and think about that and design your own plan to help yourself when you get there.
Yes, absolutely. Narrow possibilities are absolutely the thing that creates, obviously, limitations. And, you know, there are people who've been told maybe by family, by friends, maybe as a child,
yeah.
you know, that they're not good enough or, yeah. you know, things aren't going to happen for them.
Listen, I was told people don't care. People don't care. That was a mantra from my parents. People don't care.
Yeah, you're not important enough for people to care.
People don't care. And it took me decades to undo that one, to discover, yeah, people really do care. They do care. You know, when my friend came over, my friend Phil came over and banged on my door and said, I'm not going away. I went, somebody really does care.
That was proof.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was proof. And yes, we do want to know that people care because there's that sense of personal importance or value and just being alive.
Yeah.
But then I think there is that journey too of being able to be okay. I mean, at least that's how I sort of look at it. Be okay if nobody cares. which is not true, but yeah. I think, you know, so for some people, so that it does not become this hook, like, oh God, if nobody cares. And that's what I do with people. So if nobody cared, would you still live? Would you still breathe? Would you still be okay? Does it interrupt any of that? And it's like, no, none of that happens. And I think for what I've seen with those kinds of people, it sort of opens them up to experiencing the kind of people that are interested in their lives and interested in them and them interested in other people. So, you know, again, I think your book is really giving those perspectives and all of those perspectives and giving that kind of uplift that one may not think about when you're consumed by those feelings that we talked about, that dark hole that you get caught in.
Right. Yeah. And again, it comes down to the question, what if you didn't have to go there? What if it was in your power to say, not today? You know, I lost my mom 3 years ago, actually almost 4 years ago. And I was sure that I was going to go down the rabbit hole big time. I was sure of it. And I didn't. I was very sad for a very long time. And still sometimes it gets me by the throat. I miss her a lot. But I never went down the rabbit hole. Why? Because I knew what to do to help myself when that might start to appear. So I never went there. Never went there. And I was stunned. I was stunned. I had a day here, a moment there, where I felt like if I continued down that path, I might go there. And when I noticed that, I said, okay, not today. Not today. And I stepped back and I got my dog and we danced around the living room and then I got through it. So I'm not the superhuman, unbelievable, enlightened person. You know, I'm somebody who's done a lot of work, who's become very aware, who's figured out some strategies to help when I get to those places. And that's what You Aren't Depression's Victim does. It lays it out for people and say, here, you can do this too. It's not hopeless. Here's what you can do. And here's the path you can take to help yourself when you get to those places. And it's not rocket science. Is it easy? Sometimes not at all. But is it worth it? Oh, yeah. And it doesn't create a lot of pain along the way to get to that place. The pain is if you aren't aware and you fall down the rabbit hole. That's where the pain is. But what if you didn't have to? That's what You Aren't Depression's Victim is all about.
Absolutely. Yeah, that ability to dust yourself off and keep it moving because you recognize that there is reason to keep it moving and literally keep it moving. Right. Well, we are there on time. So Deborah Atlas, thank you so much for being on the Expansion Zone. It really has been a wonderful pleasure having you here and sharing with our audience.
Thank you very much for this opportunity. I really do appreciate it. Just so people know, the book, you can order it on my website or you can order it on Amazon. It's in paperback and in Kindle.
Okay, sounds good. All right. Well, to the listening audience, thank you as well for tuning in. And of course, do visit theexpansionzone.com for the archive of this show and all the other shows that that are there. And visit the YouTube channel as well and my social media page, Instagram, Facebook, all of that. And remember that to live life to its fullest. And when you do that, of course, question everything. So until next time, see you then. Shanti, 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 shanti. Oh, see you in the world.
Support for KPFK is brought to you in part by Tangent Productions, presenting an evening of reggae roots and island-inspired music featuring Catch a Fire, Long Beach Dub All-Stars, Through the Roots, and Tomorrow's Bad Seeds. This multi-generational lineup brings together international reggae ambassadors, SoCal legends, and rising voices in modern roots music for a full night of live performances. The concert will be held at the Mayan in Los Angeles on September 13th, with doors opening at 4 p.m. More information and tickets available at universe.com and kpfk.org. Give a gift to KPFK and yourself when you let us take your unwanted vehicle off your hands. Not only will your donation help support the on-air programs our community relies on every day, but you even qualify for a tax deduction. Go to kpfk.org/cars or call 877-573-5288.